8. A cover-up. Trump was impatient to meet Vladimir Putin, so much so that during the transition, he interrupted an interview with one of his Secretary of State candidates by glancing at Reince Priebus and asking, "When can I meet with Putin? Can I meet with him before the inaugural ceremony?" Trump's advisors told him that would be inappropriate, of course. A U.S. president was expected to meet with NATO allies before ever sitting down with the president of Russia, an adversary whose forces had just illegally interfered with the American election. Then there was the matter of protocol, which dictated that presidents-elect should not meet with foreign counterparts until they took office, out of respect for the sitting president. But Trump was hardly a disciple of diplomatic protocol. He knew what he wanted, and he did not want to take no for an answer. In the same meeting, he piped up again, "When do you think I can meet with Putin?" Trump had to wait 168 days into his presidency for the big moment. By now, he and Putin had talked on the phone several times, and Trump liked to brag that he shared a special bond with Putin because they were stablemates on 60 Minutes, having been interviewed separately for unrelated segments that happened to air in the same 2015 episode of the venerated CBS News show. But they had never met face-to-face until July 7, 2017, when Trump and Putin sat down on the sidelines of the Group of 20 Summit for World Leaders in Hamburg, Germany. "It's an honor to be with you," Trump said as he greeted Putin, flashing the tough boss smirk he had practiced over so many years on The Apprentice. "Your Excellency, Mr. President," Putin said, gamely flattering a man uniquely susceptible to it. "I spoke over the phone with you several times on very important bilateral and international issues, but phone conversation is never enough." The two men shook hands firmly. What they lacked in warmth, they tried to make up for in machismo. Joined by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Trump and Putin conversed for 2 hours and 16 minutes. Trump raised the matter of Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election, but once Putin denied any involvement by his government, they moved on to other topics. Putin convinced Trump that U.S. intelligence officials were trying to damage the U.S.-Russia relationship with phony claims of meddling. The Russians emerged with the distinct impression that Trump would not hold them accountable. The U.S. president said that he heard clear statements from President Putin about this being untrue and that he accepted these statements, Lavrov said, summarizing the meeting for reporters. Trump saw Hamburg as the start of a new era of diplomacy between the United States and Russia. He directed Tillerson to tell reporters that the tête-à-tête produced very clear, positive chemistry. Yet Trump, who harbored deep suspicions about the loyalty of national security and intelligence officials and had previously accused them of leaking information about his private discussions with foreign leaders to try to make him look bad, went to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversation with Putin. Trump personally took possession of the notes of the American interpreter and instructed the linguist not to discuss what had transpired with other administration officials. As a result, high-ranking officials at intelligence agencies and elsewhere in the government had no detailed record of what was discussed between the two presidents beyond the readout Tillerson provided to the media. The only detail administration officials received from the interpreter was that after Putin denied any Russian involvement in the U.S. election, Trump responded by saying, "I believe you." As he watched footage of Trump and Putin interacting, John Brennan's blood boiled. As CIA director throughout President Obama's second term, Brennan had a front-row seat not only to Russia's systematic interference in the U.S. elections, but to Putin's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine and his murderous authoritarian rule. When I saw Mr. Trump lean over and say to Mr. Putin, "It's a great honor to meet you," and this is Mr. Putin, who assaulted one of the foundational pillars of our democracy, our electoral system, that invaded Ukraine, annexed Crimea, that has suppressed and repressed political opponents in Russia, and has caused the deaths of many of them, to say up front, "Person who supposedly knows the art of the deal, I thought it was a very, very bad negotiating tactic, and I felt as though it was not the honorable thing to say." Brennan told national security professionals gathered a couple weeks later at the Aspen Security Forum. That day in Hamburg, there was still more Trump wanted to discuss with Putin. The evening of July 7th, the two men attended a gala dinner hosted by German Chancellor Angela Merkel for the G20 leaders and their spouses. Inside the gleaming modern Elbphilharmonie Concert Hall on the banks of the Elbe River, the presidents and prime ministers and their spouses ate at a long, white-clothed banquet table. Putin was seated next to Melania Trump, and Donald Trump feared he was missing out on the action. When the dessert course was served, he stood up from his own seat next to Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to take a chair next to Putin. Trump and Putin, joined only by an official Kremlin interpreter, chatted for an hour as the other leaders circulated the room looking bemused and befuddled by their animated conversation. They kept talking so long that they were among the last leaders to leave the concert hall, Putin at 11:50 p.m. and Trump at 11:54 p.m., long after their host, Merkel, had departed. An iron rule of diplomacy is that one of the most important components of the relationship between any two states is the personal rapport between their leaders. Franklin D. Roosevelt had Winston Churchill. Ronald Reagan had Margaret Thatcher. And by this point in his presidency, the list of foreign leaders auditioning to be Trump's closest ally and confidant was long. It was in most countries' interests to be friends with the United States, and foreign governments calculated that Trump could be won over relatively easily with flattery and deference. Abe raced to Trump Tower during the transition to ingratiate himself by presenting Trump with a $3,755 gold-colored golf club. The two played 27 holes of golf together in Florida in February. British Prime Minister Theresa May jetted to Washington on only Trump's seventh full day in office, hoping to reaffirm the special relationship between their two countries. They even held hands as they strolled the West Wing colonnade. But Trump had his eyes on Putin. His guide in navigating this flowering relationship was Tillerson. Of all the president's advisors, Tillerson knew Putin the best, having negotiated with him as Exxon's leader on Russian exports and later as the energy giant's chief executive. They first met in the 1990s, and they had sat across from each other several times in the years since in Putin's ornate conference room in the Kremlin. Their relationship was so close that in 2013, the same year Putin snubbed Trump by declining his invitation to attend the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow, Putin personally invited Tillerson to a celebratory event in Sochi to show off Russia's progress in redeveloping the resort city for the upcoming Winter Olympic Games. During that summer trip, Putin brought Tillerson aboard his yacht for a private lunch. Whisked to the dock by Putin's Mercedes, Tillerson stepped aboard the boat and noticed his aides were left on land when Putin's crew tossed the lines overboard and pushed off. Black gunboats flanked the yacht as they took a short jaunt out into deeper waters of the Black Sea. As they dined al fresco, Putin confided to Tillerson that he detested Obama. He argued that Obama had lied to him about claims he wanted to partner with Russia and seemed unable to make a clear decision. "I've given up on your president," Putin told Tillerson. "I'll wait for your next president and see if I can get along with him." Tillerson got along with Putin, but also had his number. Once he became Secretary of State 4 years later, he tried to use his extensive experience with Putin wisely to tutor Trump. He explained Putin's deep desire to restore Russian greatness and credibility, or at least give it the sheen of a country to be feared, in part by forging a partnership with a world power such as the United States. He stressed that Putin would always look to save face with his citizenry. And he said Putin's hidden default move was picking at his enemy's scabs. "The only thing Putin understands is truth and power," Tillerson explained to Trump. "He will lean in as far as he can until he fears defeat. The last thing he wants is a defeat with his own people." Tillerson emphasized the most important trait he thought Trump should know. Putin's moves might seem slick and quick, but he was playing a long game, always thinking several moves ahead, years in the distance. He impressed upon Trump the fact that Putin sought to destabilize Western alliances and remake the post-World War II power structure to weaken America's global influence. Putin, Tillerson told Trump, wakes up every morning asking, "Where is America having problems? Let's go there now and make it worse." He explained that Putin's government was nimble and sparked brushfires around the world, to which the United States was slow to respond. By helping Bashar al-Assad in Syria, Putin was creating a toehold for Russia in the Middle East. In North Korea, Putin was hoping to befriend Kim Jong-un and keep the United States from consolidating power in the Asia-Pacific. And Putin annexed Crimea in eastern Ukraine, dead set on proving that Mother Russia was the rightful ruler of the land and showing resolve on a matter of nationalistic pride. Before Trump's meeting with Putin in Hamburg, Tillerson visited Moscow in April 2017 to lay the groundwork. Sitting with the Russian president in the same Kremlin conference room where they had met when Tillerson worked for Exxon. As he entered Putin's bastion, Tillerson pointed first to his head. "Different hat," he said. Then to his chest. "Same man." "Da," Putin said, smiling and nodding at the gesture. They discussed contentious issues, not the least of which was the Kremlin's aid to the Assad regime, which was using Russian firepower to slaughter civilians. Tillerson also delivered a message that the United States would resist Russian aggression in Ukraine. Upon his return to Washington, Tillerson counseled Trump that the key to working with Putin was steady discipline. "With Putin, you have to stay on it every day," Tillerson explained. "He'll wait to see the pressure ease and then seize his opportunity." Trump listened to Tillerson, but to those watching, he seemed absent-minded. He did not ask questions or try to keep the conversation going. He had only one direct comment. He rejected the notion that Putin would try to take advantage of the United States. "I don't really think that's what Putin is up to," Trump said. Trump's confidence about how to handle Putin changed dramatically after their face-to-face meeting July 7th in Hamburg. Trump believed he was the expert on Russia now. He owned the relationship. Tillerson's years of negotiating with Putin and studying his moves on the chessboard were suddenly irrelevant. "I have had a 2-hour meeting with Putin," Trump told Tillerson. "That's all I need to know. I've sized it all up. I've got it." Tillerson's moral code and experience climbing the corporate ladder taught him to respect America's commander-in-chief. In this moment, he had to deploy every diplomatic skill he had acquired to tell his boss to be careful, reminding him that Putin had a history of taking advantage if he saw an opening. Putin was a master manipulator, a former KGB agent trained to find the soft spots of his foes and to exploit them. But Trump waved him off. "I know more about this than you do," Trump said. On July 7th, while Trump was focused in Germany on making a friend out of Putin, his lawyers back in the United States were bracing for a public relations catastrophe, the biggest since Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel. Over the previous few weeks, lawyers representing the president, his company, his campaign, and some of his family members had been reviewing tranches of campaign and transition period emails in preparation for turning over the records to the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, which were investigating Russian interference. The lawyers had discovered correspondence suggesting Russians had a special pipeline into the campaign, and that some people around Trump knew the Kremlin was trying to help his candidacy. They thought these exchanges were horrifying and certain to show Trump had lied, but did not necessarily pose a legal problem. Anybody with half a brain realized it's politically explosive, even if legally irrelevant, recalled one of the lawyers reviewing the material. "It's just awful stuff." The emails revealed that Donald Trump Jr. excitedly and naively set up a meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 with Natalia Veselnitskaya, a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin. In the exchanges, Rob Goldstone, a British talent promoter who was helping broker the meeting, relayed that the Russians were offering to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. "This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump." "If it's what you say, I love it," Trump Jr. wrote in one of the emails to Goldstone. Jared Kushner attended the meeting on the 25th floor of Trump Tower on June 9, 2016, at Trump Jr.'s invitation, as did then-campaign chairman Paul Manafort. The lawyers all knew that as soon as they provided the records to Congress, Democrats would release the most damaging details. After months of Trump's claiming no collusion, here was the first known meeting between top Trump campaign officials, his own family, and a Russian national. This had the makings of a full-blown crisis. Trump lawyers Mark Kasowitz and Mike Bowe had alerted the president to the existence of the emails on June 21st, but explained they likely would not become known outside their circle of lawyers until the fall, when they had to be produced to congressional committees investigating Russian meddling in the election. Hope Hicks also was working to help contain the fallout, but the president rejected his communications director's advice. As she later told the special counsel, Hicks met in the White House residence in late June with Trump, Kushner, and Ivanka. Kushner tried to show his father-in-law the emails that Congress would soon have, but the president shut the conversation down and said he did not want to know about it. Then, on June 29th, Hicks spoke privately with Trump to convey her concern about the political firestorm the emails would unleash. He told her he did not think they would leak so long as only one lawyer handled them. Later that day, in a second meeting that was attended by Kushner and Ivanka, Hicks told Trump that the emails were really bad and the news story would be massive when it broke. Hicks suggested Trump Jr. proactively disclose the existence of the emails and summarize their content in an attempt to soften the blow. But Trump reiterated that he did not want to know the details and insisted he did not believe the emails would leak to the press. Around the same time, The lawyers for Trump, his campaign, and his family members plotted different ways to get in front of the story. Kushner's lawyer, Abby Lowell, urged that one of them should leak the story to a friendly news outlet first, just before turning over the material, to shape the story in a way that put all their clients in the best light. Considered one of the very best Washington scandal attorneys, Lowell believed the meeting with the Russian lawyer was embarrassing and showed the Trump team's naivete. But he did not think it amounted to a conspiracy to collude with Russians. Lowell was elated one day when, combing through the evidence, he found emails showing Kushner arrived late to the meeting and tried to leave early. As Lowell saw it, Trump Jr., Kushner, and Manafort took a meeting with some goofy folks, including Veselnitskaya, that they shouldn't have. But no deals were struck and nothing came of it. Kushner had repeatedly joked that the Democrats' claim that Trump or his advisors might have colluded with Russians was ridiculous because the campaign was so disorganized we couldn't even collude with ourselves. Lowell wanted Trump Jr. to shoulder the responsibility for setting up the meeting and own the story. "Everyone knew Abby wanted Don Jr. to tell it," said one insider familiar with the plan. "The lawyers knew it. We had all talked about it," another said. Lowell pushed the other lawyers to get on board with a plan to leak the story to a responsible organization, such as the New York Times or the Washington Post, around the time they turned over the records. Trump Jr.'s newly hired lawyer, Alan Feuerfass, respected Lowell and saw some wisdom in this idea. But Feuerfass, hired just a week before, was still learning the facts of the meeting and wasn't comfortable going public until he knew what exactly had happened. Another lawyer who was privy to some of the information, however, was executing a plan of his own. Reginald Reg Brown represented Manafort in the ongoing congressional investigations of Russian interference in the election. And that May, he had provided several congressional committees with answers to their questions for his client. In written letters, Brown reported that Manafort didn't recall any one-on-one meetings with Russians during the campaign. However, by June, Brown had been alerted by other lawyers with access to Kushner's campaign emails that Manafort had attended the mystery meeting and had given Congress inaccurate information. Brown didn't want his client to be accused of lying to Congress and also saw an opportunity to show that his client was transparent and open. A veteran of congressional investigations, he didn't want this revelation to come out and let his guy be tagged with trying to conceal something. Brown conferred with Lowell and got his sign-off to notify various committees of Manafort's attending a meeting with a Russian. Brown's notice to the committees, which he conveyed by phone on about June 30th, just before Congress left for the July 4th recess, volunteered that Manafort attended the meeting at the invitation of Donald Trump Jr. He made no mention of Kushner's attending. Neither the Trump Organization nor Trump Jr. knew how quickly the world was about to come crashing down on their heads. Word of Brown's notification to Congress soon reached the New York Times, where on July 7th, reporters called White House officials and Trump family lawyers, saying the paper planned to write about a mysterious meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 with a Russian lawyer. Trump was 4,000 miles away from his lawyers in Washington and New York, and his aides scrambled to buy more time. Hicks proposed a conference call with the Times reporters the next morning. But the morning of July 8th came and went, with no call from the White House. And by this time, Trump and his entourage had boarded Air Force One in Hamburg to fly home to Washington. The Times reporters had put together a list of questions and emailed them to White House aides, who discussed them on the plane. They immediately realized they had a crisis on their hands. The lawyers had been dreading this looming public relations nightmare, but did not expect it to burst wide open this soon, and were caught flat-footed. The president's own lawyers, Mark Kasowitz and Mike Bowe, hadn't yet fully briefed Trump on the digital trail. They had been working with a friendly conservative outlet, Circa, which also knew a little bit about a meeting with Russians. Bowe and communications strategist Mark Corallo hoped to cast the story in a very different light than Lowell had envisioned. They told the Circa reporter that the Russian lawyer had ties to a Democratic opposition research firm and appeared to be trying to set up the Trump campaign to look stupid. But they hadn't been able to settle on a media plan with the other lawyers by that Saturday. Lowell, Kushner's attorney, was playing tennis when he was dragged off the court by an urgent call. The Times was about to publish details of the Trump Tower meeting. This was the very story Lowell had persuaded the broader legal team to carefully shape and communicate on their own terms. But now the dam was about to break, and none of them had control. When the Times inquired about the Trump Tower meeting, the person with the most firsthand knowledge of it, Trump Jr., could not easily be reached. An avid outdoorsman, the president's namesake son, then 39, was on a fishing boat on a lake in upstate New York. He had spotty cell service, and people struggled to reach him. But Hicks got to Trump Jr. with a series of texts. Trump Jr. had already carefully reviewed the emails with his lawyer the previous week, primarily to prepare a press strategy, because the emails would likely have to be released to Congress. Trump Jr. had explained that although he had been eager to take the meeting with Veselnitskaya and hoped to learn something incriminating about Clinton, he came to consider the meeting a dud. He remembered being mildly annoyed that Veselnitskaya offered no actual evidence linking Clinton to a scandal. Instead, the brunette lawyer spent most of the meeting talking about a proposed deal. The Russian government would lift a ban on U.S. adoptions of Russian children if the U.S. government revoked a law sanctioning prominent Russian billionaires. This was a personal priority of Putin's, and Veselnitskaya had for years lobbied against the Magnitsky Act, which imposed sanctions on a so-called blacklist of accused human rights abusers. As Trump Jr. later recalled, it was a wasted 20 minutes. He and his lawyers had crafted a few versions of statements for him to explain the meeting when the time came. And Trump Jr.'s preference was a detailed account, a page-long description of how he came to hold the meeting and everything that happened. Kushner, too, had reviewed his emails and texts with his lawyer before the Times call. He had remembered the meeting with Veselnitskaya as being fairly odd and unimportant. When Trump Jr. had gone fishing, Kushner and Ivanka Trump were traveling home from Germany with the president, and conferred with Hicks and Kushner's communications aide, Josh Raffel, to strategize about Kushner's response to the inquiry. Those in Germany knew the disclosure of the meeting carried political and potentially legal peril, and quickly agreed on a strategy. Trump Jr. would release a statement to the Times to contain the fallout. His account would be truthful, including the fact, which they considered helpful, that Veselnitskaya's offer of damaging information on Clinton never materialized, so it could not be repudiated later if the full details emerged, or, as the family's lawyers knew would eventually happen, copies of the emails surfaced. "It's all going to come out eventually," Federfass told some of those discussing what to do. He advocated for Trump Jr.'s position. Don't try to hide that the Russians had offered unflattering information about Clinton. A statement was drafted in Trump Jr.'s name, stating, truthfully, that he was asked by an acquaintance to meet with an individual who, I was told, might have information helpful to the campaign. Once Trump boarded Air Force One, however, the president changed course. Retrofitted for presidential travel, the military's iconic Boeing 747 is segmented by cabins. The president's personal cabin is at the front of the fuselage, near the nose, and separate cabins flow back from there, with passengers assigned to seats in descending order of seniority. Top advisors, then other staff, then Secret Service agents, then guests, such as friends or members of Congress. And finally, in the rear, a traveling pool of 13 journalists. For the first few hours of the flight, Trump worked furiously in the front cabin with Hicks to strategize about the brewing story about the Kremlin lawyer. Other aides, including White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer and his deputy Sarah Sanders, were seated in the main staff cabin, feeling excluded from the action up front. By nature a micromanager, Trump sought to minimize what he considered a public relations disaster for his son, but primarily for himself. As was often the case with Trump, he didn't know all the details, and yet he also knew what he planned to say wasn't entirely true. He was just trying to wrest control of that day's headline and survive. You all think that he has some master strategy, but really, he's just trying to get past the crisis of that moment, said one top advisor. He thought to himself, those emails aren't going to see the light of day until the fall, and we're talking about this story right now. That was an eternity to him. So Trump took charge to cover up the truth. Hicks sent Trump Jr. a series of text messages from the plane explaining that the president was proposing a different tack. They would emphasize that the meeting with Veselnitskaya was about Russian adoption policy and say nothing about the campaign. In conferring with Kushner and Hicks, Trump insisted that the statement not touch upon his campaign, but rather focus on the obscure policy connections between the ban on Russian adoptions and the U.S. Magnitsky Act. Trump Jr. conveyed his irritation that his father was crafting a statement that sidestepped the Clinton element, a glaring and problematic omission. Because the president and his aides were on a plane an ocean away, there was little chance for a thoughtful, strategic conference call with all the parties. Hicks continued to confer with Trump Jr. over text, while Trump Jr. discussed options with his lawyers, Feuerfass, and the Trump Organization's general counsel, Alan Garten. Lowell was conferring with Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Other White House aides were messaging with Garten. The president was adamant, however. In the front cabin of Air Force One, Hicks took Trump's dictation, typing up a draft she kept trying to perfect. At the last minute, Trump Jr. urged Hicks to add one final word to state that they primarily discussed adoptions at the meeting. I think that's right, too, but boss man worried it invites a lot of questions, Hicks texted Trump Jr. If I don't have it in there, it appears as though I'm lying later when they inevitably leak something, Trump Jr. replied. A little bit after 1:30 p.m., Garten emailed the Times with a statement attributed to Trump Jr., never conveying that the president himself had drafted it. It was a short introductory meeting, the statement read. I asked Jared and Paul to stop by. We primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children that was active and popular with American families years ago and was since ended by the Russian government. But it was not a campaign issue at that time, and there was no follow-up. I was asked to attend the meeting by an acquaintance, but was not told the name of the person I would be meeting with beforehand. Trump Jr., Lowell, Feuerfass, and Garten were stymied. They all knew what was contained in the full email exchange, and they knew it would eventually come back not just to bite Trump Jr., but to ensnare Trump himself. However, none of them could overrule the president from afar. By the time Trump's personal lawyers weighed in, it was too late. After Garton issued the statement to the Times, he forwarded copies to other lawyers for the president and his advisors. Beau had been trying to reach Futrefest since Friday. He wanted to get a statement from Trump Jr. for the Circa story. Futrefest had put him off, saying he'd call at 1 p.m. He didn't. At nearly 2 p.m., Beau was driving to LaGuardia Airport to pick up his wife and got the email reporting the statement that had been sent to the Times at about 1:30 p.m. He pulled over and read the statement with fury. He had crafted a press strategy that would contain a fuller explanation of the meeting, and now Trump Jr. had issued an entirely different account. He got back on the road and dialed Futrefest on his cell. "Alan, what the fuck is going on?" Beau bellowed. "Our client is the fucking president of the United States. Why the fuck didn't you contact me?" Futrefest tried to keep calm amid the string of expletives. "I didn't have a lot of control on this one, Mike," he said. "We had a plan," Beau yelled back. "You totally screwed up the plan. You didn't call me back. What the fuck?" Beau explained in more detail the plan he, Kasowitz, the lawyer Jay Sekulo, and Mark Corallo had set in motion a day earlier with Circa to neutralize the embarrassing Trump Tower meeting emails. As Beau talked, he was racing along the highway in Queens, a section of road he had driven probably 100 times. Only this time, he was so angry, he missed his exit for the airport. Futrefest was frustrated, too. He didn't like being in this spot any more than Beau. He had studied the Trump Tower meeting extensively in the previous week and actually now knew more about it than almost anyone. He had debriefed some of the lesser-known people who had attended, including Goldstone, the British publicist who had encouraged Trump Jr. to take the meeting in the first place. Futrefest snorted at Beau's strategy, which he figured no good journalist would believe. "You were planning a story on my client?" Futrefest asked Beau. "When were you going to tell me this?" "You never fucking called me back," Beau said. Futrefest said he was instructed not to call the president's lawyers. Beau demanded to know who told him that. Futrefest said he wasn't going to say. Beau was left to wonder. He picked up his wife, took her to City Island for a waterfront lunch, and tried to calm down. Beau called Kasowitz to let him know about the shit their client had stepped in without the assistance of counsel. Kasowitz called Trump on his secure phone on Air Force One. Just before 3 p.m., the president consulted with his own attorney for the first time. The Times already had the misleading statement, and there was little the president's lawyer could do except listen to his client explain his strategy. Trump's version of events was now as good as written in stone. The Times published its story later that afternoon. Kasowitz got Trump's approval for a statement he would issue to Circa, alleging the meeting appeared to be an effort to entrap the Trump campaign. But that storyline would immediately be overshadowed by the Times report of Trump family members meeting with Russians who wanted to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Trump. Lowell read the story online with dismay. The statement issued from Air Force One was highly misleading at best. There was only one silver lining. The story zeroed in on the role of Trump Jr., not on the failure, once again, of Kushner to disclose all of his foreign contacts. Lowell reached Kushner by phone on Air Force One at close to 6 p.m. and urged his client to deflect future questions about the meeting to Trump Jr.'s team. "Let's let this one fall to Don Jr.," Lowell told Kushner. "It's Don Jr.'s meeting to tell." At roughly 8 p.m., Air Force One touched down at Joint Base Andrews outside Washington. Trump's family members and advisors departed the aircraft exhausted and anxious. They knew the damage was done. The problem they scrambled to contain would only grow bigger. That night, Corallo was at the Masonic Temple in Alexandria, Virginia, watching a fireworks show when he received a call on his cell phone from an angry Hicks. As Corallo recalled the conversation, Hicks asked him, "What are you guys doing? Who the hell is Circa?" Corallo said he told Hicks the plan to provide information to Circa was approved by Trump's attorneys, and he assumed they ran it by the president himself. "I had it handled with the New York Times," Corallo said Hicks told him. "Now it's this blow-up." "You had it handled?" Corallo said he responded. "You work for the White House. You work for the president. You're a federal employee. Since when do you handle this stuff?" he added. "You just made yourself a witness in a federal investigation, young lady. Way to go." Hicks knew she would be a witness regardless, considering her proximity to the president. The next day, July 9th, tensions were still running high. Corallo got a call from the White House. Trump and Hicks were on the other line. Accusations flew back and forth, according to Corallo's account of the conversation. "Who authorized this statement to go out in my name?" Trump asked. Corallo explained that the statement provided to Circa was not under Trump's name, but rather in Corallo's name, on behalf of the president's legal team. "You guys made this a big story," Trump said. "Mr. President, this was going to be a big story no matter what," Corallo replied. He added, "We really can't have this conversation without the attorneys. This is not a privileged conversation. You really need to have your attorneys on the line. Talk to them." Hicks then told Corallo, "You guys really screwed this up. We had this all planned out. It was going to go away." "The meeting was about adoption," Trump said, defending the statement he had dictated for his son. Corallo felt a lump in his throat. He resented that Hicks was seeming to berate him in front of Trump, and he thought she was displaying a level of foolishness and arrogance that suggested she was not up to the job if she couldn't see the danger of providing a partial account. Hicks, meanwhile, was exasperated from several stressful days urging transparency and truthfulness in managing the crisis, despite the president's insistence otherwise. And she believed the statement to Circa represented an egregious lapse in judgment. Rather than containing the fire, Hicks believed Corallo and Kasowitz had poured gasoline on it. Corallo reiterated that it was unwise for them to continue the conversation without lawyers on the line, and everyone hung up. At the same time, reporters from every news organization were pressing their sources to learn what prompted the June 2016 meeting. For the Trump team, the pressure to provide answers was intense. By midday on July 9th, several reporters were hearing from their sources that the original purpose of the meeting was not Russian adoptions, but an offer of incriminating information about Clinton. The Times had enough sources diming out Trump Jr. that Garton and Feuderfass agreed it was best for their client to lay out the truthful account that they had unsuccessfully argued for the day before. So, Trump Jr. issued a statement to the Times explaining that he had met with Veselnitskaya at the request of a mutual acquaintance from the 2013 Miss Universe pageant, which his father had hosted in Moscow. "After pleasantries were exchanged," Trump Jr. said, "the woman stated that she had information that individuals connected to Russia were funding the Democratic National Committee and supporting Mrs. Clinton. Her statements were vague, ambiguous, and made no sense. No details or supporting information was provided or even offered. It quickly became clear that she had no meaningful information. Trump Jr. went on to say that Veselnitskaya redirected the conversation to adoption of Russian children and the Magnitsky Act. It became clear to me that this was the true agenda all along, and that the claims of potentially helpful information were a pretext for the meeting, Trump Jr.'s statement said. Revoking the 2012 Magnitsky Act, a little-known law, was actually one of Putin's biggest priorities. The U.S. legislation had infuriated Putin because it froze the assets and limited the travel of a circle of powerful Russian businessmen he relied upon as extensions of his own power. In retaliation, Putin had halted American adoptions of Russian children. Whenever Putin raised the issue of Russian adoptions, it was really code for his jihad to revoke the meddlesome U.S. sanctions. But when Veselnitskaya raised the adoptions code word with Trump Jr. at Trump Tower in June 2016, it sailed right over his head. Inside the West Wing, tempers flared as aides realized the magnitude of the cover-up. The story only got worse. The morning of July 11th, the White House learned the Times now had a copy of Trump Jr.'s original email exchange with Goldstone proposing the meeting with Veselnitskaya, just as Hicks had warned the president would happen. Trump Jr. was normally a cool customer, but now his emotions were running high, alternating between fury at the media and misery. He and his father had faced 3 straight days of withering news coverage because of a meeting he agreed to take, and were now about to take another hit for the 4th day in a row. Reporters and lawyers would later joke that the way the president and his aides mishandled the Trump Tower story could be the case study of a graduate seminar on how not to manage crisis communications. After long existing in the shadow of his superstar younger sister, whom their father openly favored, Trump Jr. had enjoyed playing a valued role in the campaign. But revelations about the Trump Tower meeting made him a liability to his dad. Trump Jr. and his lawyers, all in New York, agreed to hurriedly get on a conference call with the president, who was in his private chambers in the White House residence, and several other lawyers and aides. It was a quick conversation. The son had to explain to Trump the bombshell about to hit about the embarrassing emails. The president listened intently, interrupting once in a while with a groan. "I'm really sorry about this, Dad," Trump Jr. said. Trump made clear he wasn't happy, but did not acknowledge that he had caused much of the problem himself by dictating the misleading statement. "It's a fucking mess," Trump said. "It's interfering with my agenda. This is screwing up what I'm trying to do." Then the president, his son, and their advisors debated whether to release all the emails or only a portion. Trump Jr. and his lawyers recommended all of them. "The rest of them are going to leak anyway," Trump Jr. said. Trump agreed. "Fuck it," the president declared. "Publish them all." After he hung up, at a little after 10 a.m., Trump tweeted a defense of his son for the world to see. "Most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended in order to get info on an opponent. That's politics." Trump Jr., meanwhile, uploaded images of all 16 emails among him and Goldstone, Kushner, and Manafort about the June 2016 meeting with Veselnitskaya. At 11 a.m., Trump Jr. published them on Twitter. He had scooped the Times. Trump was furious about the mess that had transpired over the past 4 days. At a White House meeting with some advisors, according to Corallo, Trump tore into Corallo again, now blaming him for leaking details of the emails to the Times, which Corallo denied. Are you one of these never-Trumpers? The president asked his legal communications advisor. Mr. President, I voted for you. I supported you, Corallo replied. That doesn't mean I'm going to agree with everything you do, but I serve at your pleasure. You can dismiss me at any point. Corallo was crushed. Somehow, he had become the fall guy. He was looking for an out, and he found one a week later. On July 19th, Trump ripped into Attorney General Jeff Sessions, questioned the loyalty of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and disparaged Mueller's probe during an interview with Peter Baker, Michael Schmidt, and Maggie Haberman of The Times. The interview was a turning point in how Corallo viewed Trump. He considered Sessions, Rosenstein, and Mueller honest public servants who did not deserve to be trashed. Trump had made his job untenable. Corallo called Beau. I'm done, he said. Yeah, Beau replied. I totally get it. Corallo resigned from the legal team without so much as a presidential tweet thanking him for his service. Behind the scenes, a quiet internal Justice Department investigation about the handling of the Clinton email investigation was learning about some soap opera-style impropriety between a pair of FBI officials, a discovery that would forever tarnish the Mueller probe. Though the two officials' extramarital affair and careless texts long predated Mueller's appointment, their seeming political bias against Trump while launching an investigation of his campaign was used to smear the entire probe. On July 27th, Inspector General Michael Horowitz convened a group of senior justice and FBI officials to alert them to the texts he had uncovered between the senior counterintelligence supervisor Peter Strzok and the FBI lawyer Lisa Page. Their exchanges had made it appear that some in the FBI hoped to stop Trump from becoming president. Strzok was then working on Mueller's team. The FBI immediately yanked him off based on the embarrassing texts. Trump didn't yet know the full details about the exchanges, but he and his allies in Congress were already bashing Mueller's team as politically tainted Democrats trying to undermine his presidency. Outside the secure conference room at the Justice Department Command Center, where the Inspector General had briefed everyone on the texts, Rosenstein pulled Mueller aside in the hallway to apologize. He felt badly that a national hero was getting assailed by the president and lawmakers whose idea of public service was appearing on television and tweeting. He knew the texts, when they came out, would only make Mueller's job harder. I'm really sorry I got you into this, Rosenstein said. Mueller waved it off. I would have really regretted it if I hadn't agreed to do it, he said.